I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
And that may not even be the biggest news today.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Actually, it is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI. In Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM. In Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And on many other fine terrestrial stations. Plus, streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Well, normally, you might be able to guess what would be our top story today, that the nomination of Hillary Clinton by the Democrats as the first female nominee from a major political party in these United States, as happened on Thursday night at the Wells Fargo Arena in Philadelphia. Obviously, that's a huge story, and we will be talking about that huge story shortly with our old friend Heather Digby Parton of Salon, as she joins us to wrap up the week from the Democrats convention in Philadelphia, as she did last week with the Republicans dystopian hellscape convention in Cleveland, as she called it. But we've got what I think may be even a bigger story, a bigger, more important story in many ways, that is just breaking within the last couple of hours here as we go to air and as I'm trying to make sense of it. And before I do, let me say hi to Hillary, Clinton. I almost called you Hillary Clinton. Let me say hi to Desi Doyen. Hi.
Des.
All right. Des, help me out here if I'm being unclear with any of this, because this is huge. We've been talking for years on this program, more than a decade at bradblog.com, about voting rights, voting concerns, electronic voting systems, and specifically when it comes to voter suppression, the Republican laws, the photo ID voting restriction laws that have been passed around the country. Following, it was really the attempt after 2004 by Republicans to start putting these type of restrictive laws in place, but it didn't take off until the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and which allowed a lot of these Republican states that would have had to get federal preclearance for these laws previously to now just start putting these laws in place, no matter what the cost, no matter how restrictive they are, no matter how discriminatory they are to certain groups that tend to vote Democratic. Students, minorities,
the elderly,
and so forth. So we've talked a lot about the photo ID restrictions. Last week, we had a huge ruling from the appellate court, the most conservative appellate court in the country, the Fifth Circuit Court down in Texas, which found, in fact, that Texas's photo ID restriction was, in fact, in violation of the Voting Rights Act. That law was remanded, was sent back to the lower courts to try to find a fix, to basically say, hey, maybe you can let people sign an affidavit if they don't have the specific, narrow, strict type of photo ID that y'all are now requiring to vote. They can sign an affidavit saying, this is why I don't have an ID. and make sure that everyone can vote. That's what the very conservative Fifth Circuit Court did in Texas, cutting the knees out in many ways from under that Texas law. That was the good news last week. This week's voting rights news is even better. The Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has now struck down all of the very worst provisions of North Carolina's voter suppression law, which we had originally described after it was enacted just days after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act back in 2013. I described it at bradblog.com as the nation's most restrictive voter suppression law, as the worst voter suppression law since the Jim Crow era. Others have described that law as the mother of all voter suppression laws because it not only put those photo ID restrictions in place, but it also gutted, it did just about every voter suppression scheme that Republicans have been doing over the past few years. It did all of them in a single law. It restricted early voting. It ended same-day registration. It ended early registration, allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to register if, in fact, they would be 18 by the time of the next election. It stopped out of precinct votes from being counted. So if you went to the wrong precinct and you had to count cast a provisional ballot, that ballot would not be counted under this law. It was a huge law, just one thing after another. Well, now the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court has struck down all of those provisions, finding that they were passed by those Republicans in North Carolina with a racially discriminatory intent. In its 83-page decision, the court found that North Carolina purposely enacted this law with the intent to discriminate against racial minorities. And the Fourth Circuit held that this law actually targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision.
Wow.
This is a huge victory for voting rights, coming on the heels particularly of what we saw in Texas in the Fifth Circuit Court, and also up in Wisconsin, which also sent back that state's Republican photo ID restriction law, saying that it has to have some sort of a remedy if you don't have a photo ID, some sort of a remedy that would allow you to vote, like signing an affidavit. It can still cause trouble and confusion, but that was certainly good news in Wisconsin and in Texas. This news in North Carolina is even better. What the court found was that after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, the North Carolina promptly, quote, requested data on the use by race of a number of voting practices. And upon receipt of the race data, the General Assembly in North Carolina enacted legislation that restricted voting and registration in five different ways, all of which disproportionately affected Black voters. For example, as Slate describes in its coverage, counties with Sunday voting in 2014 were disproportionately Black and disproportionately Democratic, as the legislature discovered. So in response, the legislature did away with one of the two days of Sunday voting before the election. The Fourth Circuit writes that this is, quote, as close to a smoking gun as we are likely to see in modern times. That Sunday voting, that's considered souls to the polls day for many African Americans around the country, where they go to church on Sunday and then everyone, you know, gets together to vote. And so specifically, those Sunday early voting days, at least one of the two, was gutted by the North Carolina legislature. There was no other reason to do this, the appellate court found, other than to be able to keep disproportionately Democratic and disproportionately Black voters from being able to vote. The court went on to say the state's very justification for a challenged statute hinges explicitly on race. In other words, the statutes that were challenged as part of this law, the state said, well, you know, it's fine. We're just doing it to protect against voter fraud. But they said, but the court said the state's very justification for a challenge statute hinges explicitly on race, specifically its concern that African Americans who had overwhelmingly voted for Democrats had too much access to the franchise. The legislature's racial data demonstrated that, as the district court found, quote, it is indisputable that African-American voters disproportionately used same-day registration when it was available. In-person assistance likely would disproportionately benefit African-Americans, eliminated same-day registration, and so on and so forth. The court called it seemingly irrational restrictions unrelated to the goal of combating fraud. Which, indeed, neither this legislature nor, as far as we can tell, any other legislature in the country has ever done so much, so fast to restrict access to the franchise.
Wow. Okay, so I know we're running out of time.
Yeah.
Quickly, what happens next? Will this be appealed to the Supreme Court? The U.S. Supreme
Well,
Court.
This was a three-judge panel of the 4th District Court. So there's a couple of options here. None of them very good, frankly, for the Republicans in this case, for the anti-voting
rights,
forces.
Yes.
Yeah. They could ask for an en banc, which means a full court hearing of this. Experts who I've seen so far in just the past hour or two say those options are not very good on the 4th Circuit Court. Let's see. Slate writes that Friday's decision was issued by a 3-judge panel. If North Carolina requests a rehearing by the full court, it will almost certainly lose again. This according to Mark Joseph Stern over at Slate. Because he says the 4th Circuit Court is currently left-leaning. He says, moreover, there is simply no chance that the state can gather 5 votes on our current Supreme Court to reverse Friday's ruling. So if it ties with our 8-person
court
right
yes.
now, it would tie at best, or I should say at worst, it would likely tie 4-4, in which case the lower court, the U.S. Appellate Court, the 4th District Court, their ruling would hold.
Okay. Again, moving on quickly. So in the past, the Supreme Court has said, you have to be, the Purcell Doctrine, where you have to not change the election laws too close to an election
because
it's too confusing.
Right.
Is that something that this will hold, or that folks in North Carolina with this ruling will still not be able
to
vote?
They can try to make a play for that, as I understand. They can go to the Supreme Court. They can say, hey, yeah, our law was found to be purposely racially discriminatory. However, to change it this late in the game, to make these changes before the November election, it's just too close to the election to do that. They would have to get the U.S. Supreme Court to agree.
Okay.
And it seems to me the U.S. Supreme Court, again, at best, would probably split on that 4-4, in which case the 4th Circuit decision to nix this law, to nix these provisions. Mind you, they're not sending them back down to a lower court. Once they discovered there was a racially discriminatory intent, they said, that's it. Enough is enough. This law has got to go away. And they looked at what the record of the lower court, and they said, yeah, the lower court, which had upheld this law, the lower court correctly looked at all of the data. However, that lower court, the decision by that judge was erroneous, that the judge simply got it wrong.
Wow.
And that's going to be very hard to go anywhere with. And by the way, it's hard to get a finding that the judge determined it, just, you know, determined the facts wrong. It's hard to get that finding from an appellate court. But the voting rights advocates here, including the U.S. Department of Justice, which was suing on this law, they got what they were looking for. And it's very hard to get that from an appellate court. And yet they did. This is a very good and a very big day because this is going to have an effect on all of these laws all around the country. So while it's important to North Carolina, which is a swing state, it went very narrowly for Barack Obama in 2008. It swung back to Mitt Romney in 2012. So this is key there in the presidential race and all of the other contests on the ballot as well. But it seems like this may be the end.
This may be
the end of these photo ID restriction laws and all of these other laws that Republicans have been pretending are about stopping fraud. The 4th Circuit Court saw right through that. To a lesser extent, the 5th Circuit Court down in Texas saw right through that. I just can't overstate what good news this is for voters, frankly, of any party. If you just give a damn about voting, the good news that is represented in this Fourth Circuit Court ruling today. We will be talking about it more, no doubt, in the near future. But hey, enjoy that and enjoy a quick break. When we come back, we will talk about what we thought was going to be the big story today, the nomination of Hillary Clinton for President of these United States. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Let our legacy be about planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. That's why we're here. Not just in this hall, but on this earth. The founders showed us that, and so have many others since. They were drawn together by love of country and the selfless passion to build something better for all who follow. That is the story of America, and we begin a new chapter tonight.
There you have it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That was a nice optimistic bumper there, Desi Doyen.
Yes, I know. I made it because I felt like, hey, this is historic, and I would like to pause for a moment before we get into all the complaining and all that about this historic moment.
What makes you think we're going to complain about this historic moment? I'm doing my best. We had that very good news out of North Carolina today concerning voting rights. So suddenly I'm feeling a lot better than I was after the convention wrapped up on Thursday night. But let's take a moment to mark this historical moment before we get to our guest. This is what happened. In case you didn't hear, on Thursday night at the Wells Fargo Arena in Philadelphia.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
There you go. Hillary Clinton, the first female to be nominated for a major U.S. political party in this nation's, 250-something-odd year history. So it is with humility and determination and optimism that I welcome our guest to help us make sense of all of this today. Heather Digby Parton, our old friend, is back once again. We had her back last week after the Republican convention. Now we'll make sense maybe of the Democratic convention. She is known, of course, simply as Digby to many longtime progressive blog readers online. Heather Digby Parton is the creator of the infamous Digby's Hullabaloo blog and a regular contributor at Salon.com and the Hillman Prize winner for opinion and analysis journalism. We'll get some of that prize winning opinion right now, I suspect. Heather Digby Parton, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Thank you, as usual, for being had. It's always good to have you here. This is obviously an historic moment. So before I, begin bitching and complaining, as I probably do, not just today, but for the next 100 days until the election, and then God knows how many days after that, I want to take a moment to ponder the moment. In fact, we've got the first female candidate from a major American political party. So, and I've got two fantastic women here, Heather Digby Parton and Desi Digby Doyen. And so with that in mind, I'll turn this over to you. First off, Heather, what did you think of Hillary's white pantsuit? And what about not wearing a flag pin?
Well, the flag pin was just a horrific. Obviously, she hates America. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But we knew that, right? I mean, that goes without saying.
Yes.
The white pantsuit actually has a big significance.
Really? Well, because I ask as a joke, because a lot of people did focus on, how does she look?
I know,
how does her
hair and her voice and all the usual crapola. In fact, it got to the point, I just turned off Twitter last night.
Yeah.
I'm just going, I don't need any more of this. After listening to men, mm-hmm. Offend me with their screaming in my face like there's, the dad who's always mad for decades, in fact, my whole life, I'm just not hearing any more criticism about her voice, at least not last night. I just was not in the mood for it. And I did want to mention, though, the white pantsuit has a significance.
What is it?
Because, well, first of all, you may remember, you know, Geraldine Ferraro also wore white, and there's a reason for it, because the suffragists, as we are calling them these days, all wore white. It was a sign of their, it was kind of their uniform, their sign of solidarity. So both Ferraro and Clinton both were referring back to that movement, which gave women the right to vote, which I think is a very nice thing to do.
Yeah.
Was meaningful to me knowing that, that was part of her calculation to do it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, if you'll allow perhaps Desi and I to, you know, have a few moments of, mm-hmm. of joy in this moment, regardless of what you think about, you know, Clinton's politics or anything else, you know, the fact this is a major moment in American history, and one that I think she has from her entire life, you know, going back to the time when she was a young woman in college and becoming politically active. I mean, I just don't think there's any doubt that she has been a contributor to public life in America, doing public service, working hard at it, finding various ways throughout the meanderings of her life, which were very interesting and kind of emblematic of the women of her age group and mm-hmm. how they were negotiating all this new stuff with the feminist movement and new opportunities for women in the workplace and how they work their way through it to find she comes up at this point in her life at this age, and she is now the Democratic nominee. And, you know, I can't help but take a little pride in it and feel like it's, you know, I think I may have said this to you guys before, I can't remember, but, you know, the Democratic Party, for all of its flaws, and God knows it has many, one of the things they do and have done is when the opportunity presents itself to make a big change like this, a big symbolic change, mm-hmm. it's very difficult. You know, you've got to be in there's a particular political moment that presents itself to allow something like this to happen. I think it happened in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama, and it's happening now. And they take advantage of it. And that is not necessarily the smart political move, right? I mean, the smart political move in both 2008 and 2000 would have been to elect an average white guy, because, you know, even though you knew you were in a good position to win the election because the other side was, you know, in desperate trouble, they were in 2008 and they are again because of Trump, and yet they chose, you know, somehow collectively, subliminally, whatever, was to take that opportunity to do something like this. So I give Democrats credit for that. They are willing to expend political capital to make a big symbolic change like this. And I think that's to their, you know, / our credit that we, you know, that happens. And so another big milestone has just been passed.
Oh, I totally agree. No matter what you feel personally about Hillary Clinton as a person or about her politics or about what she's done and where she's been, she has, I think, been a transformational character, at least in American history. You know, first as a first lady, like Heather said, you know, sort of breaking through these preconceived notions about how women are supposed to act. And, you know, we continue to break through those. You know, we'll continue to find out, you know, hey, this is what it's like when a woman speaks with authority. This is what it's like when a woman has an opinion and doesn't get shouted down. And I love the fact that children now take for granted the idea that a woman can be president. And it's easy for a moment like this to be lost. But for those of us who grew up, you know, my mom was a barrier breaker herself as the first female engineer to be employed at her company. And I saw firsthand a lot of the discrimination and the barriers for women. And I know as a kid, I never thought that I was going to ever be able to even think about having a position like this. So I'm very happy to see this has happened.
I was trying to make sense of it while watching the speech on Thursday night and not being as moved as I was in 2008 when with the Barack Obama's acceptance speech, when I remember weeping at the moment, of what was going on. And I was trying to figure out while watching Hillary's speech, how much of that had to do with, well, back in 2008, you had, of course, an African-American nominated for the first time. But how much of my feeling at that point was because of that versus the end of the Bush era, which also, no, really, I mean, that felt like such an uplifting moment that, oh my God, after those 8 dark years, we're finally moving out of that. And I wonder if I might have been more moved by a Hillary Clinton nomination back then than I was 8 years later. And I'm also trying to figure out, well, how much of that had to do with the immediate comparison the night before with Barack Obama giving what was, I think, to Republicans and Democrats and independents alike, just one of the most momentous speeches in history at an event like this, his speech the night before. So she had to sort of compete with that. And then I'm trying to figure out, maybe I'm just not as appreciative, whether I like to admit it or not, of the momentousness of a woman finally being nominated by a major political American party. I don't know. And that's what I've been trying to check. That's what I've been trying to figure out. So, Heather, I mean, did it strike you? You've noted the historic milestone, but was it something on a personal level where you moved the way that Desi says she was moved by last night's speech?
Yeah, I was. There's an intense, you know, personal aspect of this. I mean, I'm a woman of a certain age. I'm not quite as old as Hillary, but I'm no spring chicken, and I've been through a lot of this stuff in my former career. I've dealt with this, you know, the kind of barriers that were put up, you know, have been put up in American life for women. I've watched Hillary go through what she's gone through in a number of different ways. I think many women, particularly maybe women of my age, you know, the middle-aged type women, who, you know, can kind of relate to a lot of the way that she was sort of dealt over the course of her life. So there is a personal aspect to this. But there was something else, I think, last night that was really meaningful to me, which was that, you know, I think, and I don't think this is, she broke a barrier, but she won't be the last one to do this. But I think it was important that it be a woman of a certain level of maturity and experience that did this thing. Because she stood up there, and I think she looked, for the first time in history, a woman looked absolutely presidential. I don't think there was any sense that she was not a leader, that she wasn't confident, that she didn't have tremendous backbone, empathy, all the usual things that you think about when you, you know, sort of want a leader. Now, whether or not you like her personally or have some issues about her, you know, her politics or whatever the things are that you name, Brad, and I suspect it's all a combination of those things. We've known her for a long time, mm-hmm. so, you know, people have their feelings about her, and it comes from any number of directions. But nonetheless, nobody looked at her and went, I don't think, except for Donald Trump, looked at her and went, that's not a president. Mm-hmm. That doesn't look like a president. That doesn't look like a leader. And that's really meaningful. I mean, that's one of those symbolic moments where I think, you know, you saw this woman of hard-won experience, very intelligent, very competent, very capable. That is the baseline now. You know, that's that. Women can be seen that way, regardless now, you know, beyond that, they have to prove themselves, you know, in the job. They've got to be people who if she was a Republican and was spouting off about, being anti-choice or, you know, mm-hmm. doing all the usual stuff that Republicans say, you know, I wouldn't have been impressed with her either, but just, you know, the symbolic moment of seeing that woman standing up there in front of that big crowd with authority, I think was a big thing. And it certainly meant something to me.
How important, before we move on to the specifics of what she actually had to say and how, you know, what effect that may have had on both Bernie Sanders supporters, who she still needs to reach out to, disaffected Republicans, who I know she's still trying to reach out to. Before we quickly move on to that, how important for those of us, you know, like me, just too young to remember it, how important was Clinton's statement back in, what, the 90s, 98, I think it was, at the, or 96, at the UN Women's Conference in Beijing, when she stood up and said, women's rights are human rights, and human rights are women's rights, and it was something that in China, People were warning her against saying. Is that something that you remember, Heather, as, you know, as meaningful on both a political level and as a woman?
Oh, you bet I do. And I remember it very clearly. You know, it was during that, you know, weird churning period after the 96 election when all kinds of stuff was happening. I think it was before the Lewinsky thing, but there was mm-hmm. all kinds of, you know, the usual, you know, right-wing scandal-mongering craziness. And she went over and did this thing. And, you know, when she came in, I mean, this is one of the things that's most curious about Clinton. And, in fact, Michelle Goldberg wrote an interesting article about, you know, why do people hate Hillary? And she interviewed a bunch of people who hate her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reasons are all over the place. You know, there's nothing consistent about it. Back in those days, she was considered this, you know, feminist harpy, you know, so far to the left that she was dragging poor old Bill into all his, you know, horrible policies, horrible left-wing policies, you know, because she was such a, you know, hardcore Saul Alinsky, you know, radical,
right.
Which now, of course, it's the total opposite. But that particular speech, for me, I remember hearing about it. I don't think I heard the actual speech until it was, you know, replayed. I don't recall hearing it in real time,
mm-hmm.
but reading about it and thinking to myself, oh my God, that you have to actually say that.
Yeah.
You know, that this is something that is not so, I mean, it's only half the population of the planet, you know, and everybody's got mothers and everybody's got sisters and, you know, daughters and, you know, girlfriends and wives, and oh my God, you have to actually state categorically that women's women are human, essentially.
It was,
and I'm going,
we laugh
people
now.
Were shocked by it,
yes.
and angry about it. I mean, the right wing was absolutely livid how awful that she would go do that. And it was one of those things that proved what a hardcore, I can't remember what they used to call her, hardcore feminist, hard left feminist, something like that. And it was like
radical.
It was an epithet. Yeah, a radical feminist. You know, it was an epithet. You know, she was considered to have done something really out of line, and this was, you know, which is just, even at the time, I'm going, you've got to be kidding me,
yeah.
You know?
Well, it was a huge thing at the time, and I mention it because I think there's a lot of people now, a lot of voters now, a lot of young Bernie Sanders supporters now who really have no sense of that, and I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean, they're just younger. They don't remember
sure.
it. And, you know, it is notable, and it is an important part of her record. And even at the time, there was folks on the left who were saying, don't do this. It's a bad
yeah.
political idea. And she did do it anyway. So that just needs to be in the stew, I think, for people as they're, you know, considering, particularly the Bernie Sanders folks, as they consider what to do in the next 100 days, how to cast their vote, if to cast their vote. Now, a big trick of the week for the Democrats, obviously, was trying to reach out to those Sanders supporters and a very divided party. Well, I don't want to say a very divided party, a divided party. We'll see how divided it turns out to be. But there was a rocky start to the week with the DNC email leaks and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, head of the DNC, resigning in its wake. But a lot of the speakers throughout the week, it seemed to me, including Obama and Biden and vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, tried to reach out to the Sanders folks, including Hillary Clinton herself during her acceptance speech on Thursday night. Let me play a clip of that reach out, that reach around, if you will, to Bernie Sanders folks. Go ahead.
I want to thank Bernie Sanders. Bernie, your campaign inspired millions of Americans, particularly the young people who threw their hearts and souls into our primary. You put economic and social justice issues front and center where they belong. And to all of your supporters here and around the country, I want you to know, I've heard you. Your cause is our cause. Our country needs your ideas, energy, and passion. That is the only way we can turn our progressive platform into real change for America. We wrote it together. Now let's go out and make it happen together.
Now, I often talk about the difference between skepticism, which is good, and cynicism, which is not quite as good. And so I point to Hillary's comments there and throughout the speech about the specifics that come from that platform that she and the Sanders folks put together. She did not have to cite the platform. That is not necessarily something that is, you know, has to move forward. The Republican platform they crafted is totally separate from anything that Donald Trump says he believes in. But she laid down that marker for that platform, for a lot of other progressive programs that have come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. So I'm, you know, skeptical about her getting it done, but the cynicism that I hear from people, she did not need to talk about that platform. That is now something that she can be held to, because she brought it up time and time again in the speech. She brought it up, you know, all of those progressive policies. If she's elected, she's got a re-election in 4 years that Dems can now use this against her. So, did that work, Heather, at least enough for the Democrats to accomplish what they needed to in shoring up the base? Or have people become so cynical now that they'll say, ah, yeah, whatever. She's just saying what she needs to say at this point to get elected.
I think there are probably a few people for whom that will not be adequate, you know, for a lot of reasons. You know, they're not going to buy into that. And you know, that's fine. But I actually think that, and it wasn't just her, although, as you say, she did not have to, embrace the party platform in such detail in that big speech the way that she did. Very easy to elude that and just sort of talk in broader terms and more, you know, broader principles and whatever. But she was very specific about it. And it wasn't just her, though. I mean, Barack Obama, as you say, Biden, you know, Tim Kaine, Michelle Obama, everybody who spoke, all of the key, you know, the headliners, mentioned the Sanders campaign, extolled them for what they did, gave them a lot of credit, and were, you know, very, I felt, very generously, you know, inviting to that group. And I suspect that it worked on many people, at least those at home. You know, I know in the hall there was a different atmosphere. But if you were, I mean, I assume you guys watched it at home. Mm-hmm. I did. And what I saw on television was actually, you know, it started off, as you say, as a rocky sort of beginning with the Debbie Wasserman Schultz thing and all that, which I actually think was good. I mean, they didn't plan it, of course, but the fact that it sort of it allowed that you know, that voice to be heard, it allowed people to kind of be able to get off some steam about this, and
it was,
you know,
a success. It was a success for the Bernie Sanders supporters.
It was. They ended up, and deserved. I mean, you know, what was revealed in those emails was unacceptable. Mm-hmm. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was terrible head of the DNC. Mm-hmm. Much of the reporting that came after that showed that it's not just the Bernie Sanders people who were dissatisfied. Most of the political establishment in the Democratic Party was dissatisfied. Obama didn't want to he just didn't want to make the step of having to fire her in his last year, because it would have caused a lot of, you know, he just didn't want to, for whatever reason, not because he loved her by any means, but just he just didn't want to do that. So, you know, it was time. She had to go. It well overdue, everything that came out in that, and I felt like that was a deserved response on the part of the DNC, and I felt like the Bernie people, and Bernie himself, who has to get a lot of credit for handling it the way that he did. I thought it was very deft, the way that he did deal with that. So, you know, the convention throughout, I think, was trying to be embracing of Bernie Sanders, and I think that they did a good job. I think most people will buy into it. But there was a bigger thing going on there too. It wasn't just that. I think it started off, you know, with the rocky Debbie Wasserman Schultz business, and then the first night of the convention, which of course featured the big speech by Bernie at the end, Michelle Obama and Elizabeth Warren. I mean, these were big speeches, and they were very important, and they were particularly Warren and Sanders, hardcore progressive speeches. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, I believe, that the party itself, the Clinton campaign specifically, was trying to say, hey, look, this is part of our thing. You know, they didn't have to make it. They could have spread it out. You know what I mean? They could have put Elizabeth Warren on another night. They could have put, you know, whatever. They wanted to make it very clear that this progressive movement that Sanders had revealed, I don't honestly believe he created it. I think it was already there waiting to be revealed to the party. He was just the voice that made it, you know, come together in a way that everybody could hear it. And presidential campaigns are good for that. But, you know, that was a very important thing. Then beyond that, they started to try, and this I thought it was really well done, you know, in increments, start to reach into the, you know, the more moderate Democrats, then the moderate Republicans, the suburban, you know, Republicans who were disaffected by Trump, going on and on and on. And then at the end, after they had done that, they're inviting everybody, right? They're saying, look, we are progressives, and you are the core of our party. Now, we also have room for you. We have room for you. We have room for you. And then Clinton, at the end, by embracing the platform the way she did, having put the Democratic Party at the center of American politics, she has now said, that's the center. That progressive platform is where the center of America is. That's the mainstream.
And
going forward, that is the mainstream philosophy of America. And I think that was a bold step for her to make, and I felt like it could end up being important because this election may just finish off a realignment that's been in the making for a long time, in which college-educated white voters who have traditionally always voted, a majority always voted for Republicans, they are now in a position of coming over the same way that the Reagan Democrats moved to the Republican Party.
And
that could be very, very substantially different. By the way, many of those people are older, and they might even vote in a midterm. So, you know.
Here was that reach out to a lot of those people. And as you say, Heather Digby Barton, that marker that, you know, is laid down that here, this is the new center. When she reached out to folks saying, join us, and she named things like unfair trade deals, affordable health care for all. Let me play just a quick clip from that, and then we'll get your thoughts.
Whatever party you belong to, or if you belong to no party at all, if you share these beliefs, this is your campaign. If you believe that companies should share profits, not pad executive bonuses, join us. If you believe the minimum wage should be a living wage and no one working full time should have to raise their children in poverty, join us. If you believe that every man, woman, and child in America has the right to affordable health care, join us. If you believe that we should say no to unfair trade deals, that we should stand up to China, that we should support our steel workers and auto workers and homegrown manufacturers, then join us. If you believe we should expand Social Security and protect a woman's right to make her own health care decisions, then join us. Yes, if you believe that your working mother, wife, sister, or daughter deserves equal pay, join us.
Now, Bernie Sanders could have said those exact words, frankly, in an acceptance speech, and his supporters would have gone wild. Hearing it from Hillary Clinton, you know, you kind of look and you say, well, how much of this is politics? But when you say specific, when you offer specifics like that, I think in a speech like that, it is something that she can be held to, and that she will be held to if, in fact, she's elected. Let me take a quick break. I got to get a quick break, and I want to come back with what I think was one of the most effective moments of the entire week. We're speaking with Heather Digby Parton of Salon and with Desi Doyen of The Bradcast. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with more right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. After an historic week in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention and the nomination of Hillary Clinton by the Democrats for President of the United States. I'm speaking with Heather Digby Parton of Salon, and I want to get into where we are in this matchup against Donald Trump, between Hillary and Trump. But before we do, I think for my money, one of the most amazing moments of the Democratic Convention all week was when Khazir Khan, the father of a young man who was killed in, I believe it was Iraq, Desi Doyen?
Yes.
Was killed in Iraq, who had stepped in front of essentially a car bomb, saving the lives of a bunch of his fellow U.S. troops. He is a Muslim American. His father and his mother, in full
hijab
garb,
yep,
spoke. The father spoke. We've condensed the time, the pauses in his remarks, because the applause went on and on here. But it was really an amazing takedown, I thought, of so much of what Donald Trump stands for. Let me just play this. This is Khazir Khan, the father of this soldier killed in Iraq.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. In this document, look for the words liberty and equal protection of law. Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing, and no one. We cannot solve our problems by building walls. This is a historic election, and I request to honor the sacrifice of my son. And on election day, take the time to get out and vote. And vote for the healer. Vote for the strongest, most qualified candidate, Hillary Clinton, not the divider. God bless you. Thank you.
Digby, your thoughts on Khazir Khan's remarks?
Well, for me personally, it was the most powerful speech of the convention. Mm. I mean, there were a lot of great orators and a lot of great speakers and many people who actually broke my heart. The mothers of the movement were amazing. The woman who lost her child in Orlando, in the Orlando massacre, was amazing. And there was a lot of heartfelt testimony at the convention. But this one was the amazing dignity and courage of that man, and the indignation of that man that his son's sacrifice and his own sacrifice was being devalued by Donald Trump was just so incredibly powerful. I read an interesting thing online that right after his speech that Google showed tremendous spikes in how do I register to vote.
Yes.
On Google.
Yes.
The kind of thing that makes you go, you know, wait a minute. And I think that it underscored one of the great themes of the convention, one that, you know, has, you know, many dimensions, which is that, you know, the democratic patriotism, or American patriotism, excuse me, is not about, you know, flag waving. Patriotism is about this greater idea of a country full of peoples from everywhere contributing to this one, you know, our common wheel. And I think that that was the idea that was sort of the underpinning there, in direct contrast to the dystopian hellscape return to antebellum America or whatever it was that Donald Trump was trying to do. This was a very different version of what American love of country, perhaps that's a better way of putting it than patriotism, that, you know, loving your country is about a whole different set of values than what those people were selling. And, you know, you could tell that it hit home because of all the Republicans who were so mad and so upset and so depressed, writing tweets and essays about how they stole our ideas, they took them. Well, actually, that's not true. Those ideas belong to every American.
Exactly.
It's just that Republicans have made it impossible for you know, anyone but them to be able to use it as some kind of an advertising brand. Well, you know, Trump has taken that and thrown it in the garbage. And so now people are able to see a different version of what American love of country might mean. And I don't mean that in a jingoistic way or any kind of, you know, militarism or any of that. I'm just talking about the basic idea that I think most of us of all political stripes sort of feel, that the idea underlying the, you know, and they use the founders too, which was a big thing, the idea underlying our country was always this idea that we could, you know, we were self-governing, we could make, and Obama did a good job with that too. He said, we do not want to be ruled. That one kind of sent a shiver down my spine. I'm going, whoa, you know, that is really getting down to basics. And I felt like that was the underlying story. And this man was at, and his wife, these two amazing Americans who had immigrated from another country and whose son gave his life defending America, that, you know, or I shouldn't say defending America, in uniform, and basically was killed in the name of America. That those people stood up there and you know, were, it took it right to Donald Trump, went right in his face and said, you want to ban people like me? Really? You know, this is what you want to do?
No more powerful statement.
And there was that patriotism you talk about, the Democratic brand of it. There was, in addition to that, a lot of flag waving, in fact, and a lot of chanting USA, USA. Now, to me, and a lot of militarism at times, and to me, I find that distasteful, frankly. But on a political level, the fact that they were able to take that away from the Republicans, who really didn't talk about veterans, about the military, hell, even about God, you know, who Republicans have thought they owned up until now, the fact that they did not do that at their convention, and the Democrats did, just on a political level, that's really smart, whether you like it or not. You know, it's just smart politics. I got just time for one more segment here before I got to let you go, Heather. This was Hillary and I guess previewing the Twitter election we will now be holding between now and November.
So just ask yourself, do you really think Donald Trump has the temperament to be commander-in-chief? Donald Trump can't even handle the rough and tumble of a presidential campaign. He loses his cool at the slightest provocation. Imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
So, Heather and Desi, very quickly, we've got just a minute or two here. Will this full frontal attack, you know, against Trump by Hillary Clinton, will it work? Can she stand up against Trump in the debates? And, you know, who is likely to use all sorts of, you know, jujitsu, which have nothing to do with policy, to throw her off? You know, can she stand up to it? Will this be an effective strategy to take him on in this way, Heather?
Well, I think she has to. And how she does it, I think, you know, remains to be seen. But I think saying that, I read a report by Celinda Lake, the pollster, and they have found that people, the thing that scares people most, that gets them the most when they think about Donald Trump, is the idea of him being commander-in-chief and having control of the nuclear arsenal. That, it seems to me that what they're trying to do with that, a man who can be baited, you know, with a tweet, it's the idea that this guy's a hothead that you can't trust to be deliberate and careful and listen to advisors. And he's proving over and over again that he is not that kind of a person. So, you know, I think that that's the point that they're trying to make. I also think, just to hit back, but go back to your previous comment about the flag waving, which I think most of us anti-war progressives are uncomfortable with. I think part of that has to do with the trying to inoculate a little bit against the fact that there could very well be some kind of a major terrorist attack between now and November, and the idea that they're trying to, you know, set the table for them to be seen as a strong, you know, party to do that. I mean, it seems to me like it sort of made sense, considering current events and how things have been unfolding the last few months, that the one thing they don't want is for Donald Trump to be this big man on a white horse who's going to save us if a terrorist attack of that kind should happen, that, you know, you don't want that event to be completely unaddressed.
Indeed. If it does, all bets are off.
Yeah. I just want to say really quick that I don't think anything she says will work on hardcore right-wingers. Maybe the middle, the independents, some of them will be convinced. But I love the fact that the woman nominee was the one who argued that her male opponent is the one who's going to be hysterical, irrational, and unstable.
Indeed. And we'll also have to talk about what color his pantsuit is
When can we talk about Donald Trump's, you know, various physical anomalies?
Oh, we got 100 days to do exactly that. Heather Digby Parton, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Really appreciate it. Hope you get a few days off after these hellish couple of weeks.
I'm going to go to the
beach. Good. Enjoy it. We'll talk to you soon. Heather Digby Parton of Salon and of Digby's Hullabaloo, which you can find at digbysblog.blogspot.com, and also harass her on the Twitters at Digby56. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, including the top of the show and the huge news that the North Carolina, the mother of all voter suppression laws, has now been struck down in pretty much in full by the Fourth Circuit of Appellate Court, the U.S. federal court there. If you missed any of that huge news, go back and download our show at bradblog.com, where you can get all of them for free at any time. You can also get them over at iTunes. My thanks as well to our producer, Desi Doyen, for a hell of a 2 weeks covering these conventions. Thank you, Desi. And, of course, to my guest, Heather Digby Parton. You can send me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. Or you can reach me and harass me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Man, could I use some rest. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.